Today is Wednesday. It's May 8th, 2024, and it's 2:41 in the afternoon. This is John Williams. Thanks for finding the Mincing Rascals podcast, portions of which will be broadcast Saturday night on WGN Radio. And good for you if you signed up for our Mincing Rascals podcast live recording. We're going to be doing that at the Winters Jazz Club next month. And you know, while those have sold out, we're going to try and do another one in the fall. We hope you can join us then, too. You can hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute, and you can check out my book, The New Chicago Way.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter columnist and now writing the Chicago History website, Roseland Chicago 1972.
I'm Eric Zorn. I write the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter, and in tomorrow's edition, Thursday's edition, there will be an autobiographical essay by Kate Plies about her life in Chicago and as a journalist.
Oh, no kidding. Is this where you interview her and then put her on your thing?
Yeah.
You did that for several of us over the course of the
month. I've done that for everyone.
By the way, they cannibalized your reporting for the West Suburban Living magazine, which just did a feature about me and my show, and they needed to get my sort of biography, and I don't remember all of it. But you did such a good job reporting it, Eric, that they just said, hey, can we take the Eric Zorn thing and kind of cut it up? And you and I agreed to let him do that.
Oh, sure. That's fine.
So I've been going in the Eric Zorn back catalog for Chicago Bears stuff because I was looking at what other people were writing about the renovations in the early 2000s, and Eric had some great columns on that.
You should have been a newspaper columnist, Eric.
I should have been, yeah. I could have been a contender.
Well, this week on Hey You Damn Kids, Get Off My Lawn, protesters across the city's college campuses have confronted, to varying degrees, our city's police. The question is, what should the police or school administrators do or have done? For instance, you might ask, can't they just wait these kids out? Those kids standing linked arm to arm will eventually get hungry or have to pee, so why do the cops physically have to remove them? Ditto for those encampments. Oh, I know, maybe because they are violating a law or an ordinance or a campus rule. Some people want to study or go to the Art Institute without feeling intimidated. That's why. And now the students and their stuff have been removed. The complaints and videos and investigations about how the cops handled things are starting to come in. The Civilian Office of Police Accountability has opened one preliminary investigation. Overall, how do you grade the city on this, Austin? Did the cops and school administrators handle these things pretty well?
I think University of Chicago specifically did handle it pretty well. Especially compared to some other colleges. And University of Chicago has long been known as kind of a bastion of free speech. They have this famous Chicago statement that is read to every student upon their enrollment in the university. It's important to remember that it is a private university and they can set their own rules about their private property. But at the beginning of the encampments, the president issued a statement essentially saying, we are speech maximalists and we will even be lenient toward this. But here are some ground rules. And there are basic ground rules with how we can properly exercise free speech, namely that your exercise of free speech can't violate other people's rights. And also the restrictions on any kind of that speech need to be viewpoint neutral. So, for example, there are some rules at University of Chicago that you can't erect structures on the quad or public property. Bringing in 100 tents and sleeping 24/7 and living on the quad would be in violation of that. And so protesters were given several notices that they were in violation of this policy, I think three or four, lasted around 4 days. And then on the fourth day, they were given a final notice basically saying, you have decided not to move. Here are the consequences. Here is what we're going to do. And then that was carried out. And I think that's exactly the right kind. If anything, they should have done it earlier because the longer you let the rules be broken, the harder it is to kind of put the genie back in the bottle, so to speak, as we've seen in Columbia, for example. So I would grade Chicago. Now, I can't say I've reviewed every piece of body cam footage, so I won't say that, like, perhaps people were roughed up or treated unfairly. But in general, in broad strokes, I feel like University of Chicago has handled this well.
Yes, I went to take a look at it on Friday. I just thought, there it is. I should go see what's going on in the neighborhood. you know, they like to promote it as a bunch of peaceful, friendly, community engaging people who were just happened to be camping out against the rules. You know, they were friendly if they thought you agreed with them. I'm sure they engaged very much with the people who agreed with them. But what I saw was exactly what I've seen on videos from the other encampments, which is that if they don't think you agree with them, they try and make you get out and they will not discuss anything. They just turn into kind of robots and start spouting certain lines. That said, they weren't being super violent, not like some of what we've seen on some of the other campuses. That's true. But however, they were being extremely disruptive. They were using amplification all day long in this quad, which is surrounded by buildings, holding classes all day, very much against the rules that Austin was mentioning. You're only supposed to do that during lunch hour and after 5 o'clock, and they were doing it all day long. They were also tearing down the permitted banners that had been placed by some pro-Israel students. And then you probably heard there was a little bit of a confrontation there Friday, which I got to see some pro-Israel and sort of pro-Israel, pro-American, because the pro-Palestinian side is seen as being, and usually is also sort of anti-American. They're usually chanting anti-American slogans as well. The counter side came up with American flags as well as Israeli flags, and they kind of met in the middle of the quad and yelled at each other, and some riot police kept them apart. So it didn't turn into a UCLA brawl, and that's great. But it's kind of points out why these encampments are such a bad idea. They inevitably lead to these kinds of confrontations, no matter what anyone's best intentions
might
be.
Yeah, but maybe that's the idea. Maybe that is the idea.
But why? Oh, so that's what they want, you mean? Well, my point is that the universities do have a very valid point in wanting to avoid violence.
Right, a bad idea if you're the university, maybe, but I mean, those things are waiting for confrontation.
Exactly.
How do you grade them? A, B, C, D, the way the cops handled it in the administration?
As a U of C alum, I personally don't think they should have allowed it to begin with.
Hmm. Well, there's something ironic about this because the University of Chicago's free speech policies are meant to encourage debate. They are meant to make it so that you can voice heterodox or controversial opinions and have them engaged on an intellectual academic basis. They're not necessarily there so that people can harass other people. And I think there's a real difference between protesting and harassing people. I think they had crossed that line in some of these places. When it comes to the police response, I feel like the lack of images that we've seen so far and that perhaps don't even exist of police like beating students or bloodying them, the kind of things that we saw in a lot of the footage from the 68 convention, for instance, or dragging them off when they're screaming and so on. You haven't seen video like that. It seems to me like that the police, from what I've seen, have reacted pretty well to this. They have been spat at and pushed at, and that they have shown restraint in what we have not seen in terms of the scenes from these protests. And even this stuff at the Art Institute, where COPA is apparently looking into them, mm-hmm. I mean, these, you know, there was some shoving going on, but nobody was getting like the crap beaten out of them. And it feels to me like the police did a pretty good job here. The thing, and one other thing about these encampments, the point is to draw attention, but one could say, well, why not just leave these students alone, let them camp out on the quad until graduation and we'll be fine. But they always have to escalate this. They can't, like in Columbia, they had to go and take over the hall because they weren't getting the attention they wanted to get out of just being there. That there's no, when your purpose of your protest is to harass people and to annoy them and to get in their face, an encampment isn't going to do that. You can walk by an encampment. You can shut the windows. You can, you know, it's like it's not enough. And I mean, if you remember, I'm sort of train of thought here, but remember the Occupy Wall Street protests and how feckless they were, how sort of embarrassingly feckless. I remember seeing them. I was at San Francisco, saw them, some in New York, and they were just like people gathered together living there, camping out, occupying wall. And like people, after a while, people are just like, this is annoying. And they never went anywhere. And I think that the lesson for that is, if you're going to do a protest like that, you have to bother people. You have to hassle them. You have to break some windows. And that's where the police have to step in. And it seems to me like they did a really good job in the Chicago area. I would be willing to be corrected about that if anyone's got video that shows otherwise.
Just one point to remember, the police that cleared out this encampment were University of Chicago police. And what we know now is that the University of Chicago made the city aware that they were going to do this. And they reached out to the Chicago Police Department well in advance and said, we're doing this. And they requested support from the Chicago Police Department. And the Chicago Police Department declined to support them. Hmm. And Brandon Johnson issued a statement on Tuesday morning saying that they, quote, reached out to University of Chicago leadership to reiterate serious safety and operational concerns about this plan. And then the office did not specify what the concerns were about the plan. And this is where I think the 68 comparisons become very relevant, because part of why 68 ended up so poorly was this, especially under Daley. Daley had this sort of strategic ambiguity about whether or not people will be allowed to protest in certain places, whether they can camp in certain places. And specifically, protesters were led to believe that they might be able to camp in Lincoln Park. And then Daley said, no, no, you're not. And then they kicked them out in a pretty violent confrontation. And that set the stage for the bigger confrontation down the road. And so what I think the University of Chicago example gives us a great example of is that there needs to be very clear rules set from the administration saying what will be tolerated and what won't be tolerated. We could talk more about that, but that I think is another lesson from this.
No, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that really caught my eye, that the University of Chicago wanted the Chicago police. And of course, early on, Superintendent Snelling was, you know, specifically made his statement that that they don't want to escalate. They're just going to hang back and wait to be asked by any institution to come in and help them. Then UofC says, please come help us. And they say no. And they won't tell us why. But that is all about what's going to possibly be happening at the convention. And I'm not seeing any good reason why they refuse to help the UofC police. Mm-hmm. And I understand, I think, without knowing more about it, and I wish I did, I think I can see why they did go in there around 4:30 in the morning. The students were rallying and had only just then gone to bed a little bit earlier before that 4:30. And in the previous 2 days, because on Friday, the university president issued his letter saying, okay, we've negotiated, we are in an impasse, I'm sorry, this has to come to an end. And all weekend, they let them bring in literally wire fences, giant wooden pallets. They had encircled the entire encampment with this barricade, such that they made it look like it was going to be very difficult and made it more dangerous, potentially, to clear out that encampment. It really does kind of make sense that they would have gone in when they thought the fewest people were there,
right,
and were least likely to put up a fight. Is that not what we actually would like them to do, rather than show up when there's lots and lots of people spoiling for a fight? That doesn't seem like the right time to do it either.
I couldn't help but also have just an emotional reaction to some of the pictures in the Sun-Times, which showed the University of Chicago police standing there, and they've formed a wall, and then there are some protesters, and they are right in their face, pointing their fingers at them, just begging for reaction. And then they've got the video. Then they've got the snapshot. Now look at what the police are doing to us. What are those cops do to you? But I pity the police in these instances where they're being asked to maintain the peace and people are just egging them on, and they just stand there and take it. And largely they did. When they did start to remove some of the stuff at both the Art Institute and the University of Chicago, they didn't do so gingerly. For instance, the description in the newspaper, which said the video posted to X shows one officer pushing a protester in the head with his open hand and then doing the same to another protester. Guidelines for the police department require members to only use force that's objectively reasonable. They go into all of the details about the way the police are supposed to react. The people that were protesting, quote, accused law enforcement of yanking people's hair, strangling and hitting people with batons and metal fences at the protest outside the gate, in addition to hitting, elbowing, and slamming protesters to the ground. I guess it depends on what exactly happened there. But if we have to physically remove you and your stuff, and you're not going to cooperate, and you weigh 192 pounds, that's what it looks like.
I have not seen video of the things that you described there, John. And you know, some of the stuff, sound, I mean, pulling hair, it doesn't sound good. I mean, we're talking about a country where, you know, there's a big concern about police shooting people when they shouldn't be shooting them, and the, you know, the George Floyd story. So when someone gets shoved or pushed to the ground or so on, I can't get too exercised about that. It feels like when these people are attacking and spoiling for a fight, they're pushing forward, they're trying to go where the police don't want them to go, and then they're pushed with an open hand, and then they suddenly collapse in a heap of aggrievement. I'm not there with them on that. I think you're spoiling for a fight. You want the attention that a fight's going to get. You want this video.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't rise to this level of outrage. Like, what are we supposed to do? What are the police supposed to do when these people are persisting on breaking the law? It's not like they said you can't speak. It's not like anyone is saying your views on this conflict in Gaza are forbidden. You can't say them. You can have a bullhorn. There's all sorts of ways that people can express themselves. But if you feel like you have to shove into the police and start a confrontation with them, and then you start bleeding and screaming when they respond in a fairly measured way, it seems to me. I mean, I don't know. Maybe, like I say, I'm willing to change my mind if you can show me video of things that are objectively unreasonable. And there's no question that Chicago police have reacted unreasonably with too much violence in the past. No doubt about it.
Right.
But I'm not sure that this is an example of that.
Let's be clear. We all agree that if we start seeing actual evidence, videos and other evidence that police really were strangling people, pulling hair unnecessarily, things like that, that'll be different. But it is a little bit telling that those videos are not really out there yet, because I've looked at the ones that are out there so far and they're not impressing me. The one I really want to see police disciplined if they do overreact. But the evidence for that is not quite out there yet. And that is a completely different question as to whether the encampments should be there. Under the First Amendment, they have no right to be taking up public property, private property. The Art Institute specifically offered the students a different place for their little encampment, and they refused it. At U of C, they literally could have been out there every single day, all day long as they didn't put up camps and stay there.
The 68 is a good example of there is such a thing as police violence. There is such a thing as a police riot. Yep. And that happened, and they deserve a lot of blame for actually what happened in 68. However, we have groups where and police violence is inexcusable. There are also groups wherein and protests wherein provocation is the point, and that needs to be recognized. And this was the case with the group several weeks ago when Byron Sigcho Lopez was trotted out in front of city council for a censure vote. He was partnering with this group behind enemy lines. And mm-hmm. the most controversial thing to me about that encounter was not that he spoke in front of a burned flag. Some people reacted viscerally to that. The problem was he partnered with this group behind enemy lines who reject peaceful protest because that's for sissies and no one cares about peaceful protests. We need to confront and provoke mm-hmm. and make, quote, bruises from Chicago police batons, the 2024 back to school fall fashion. And Byron Sigcho Lopez, as a public official, is partnering with those people. So I fell out of my chair this morning when I was reading the New York Times.
Yeah.
Quoting Byron Sigcho Lopez saying, we shouldn't have the DNC in Chicago because the counter protesters are going to bring violence and chaos to the city of Chicago. And it was the perfect, like the meme of the guy in the hot dog costume who drives the car into the retail store and says, I'm just trying to find the guy who did this. and there was a guy in a hot dog costume who drove it into the store. It was the most perfect example that I've ever seen in real life. I could not believe that this person was quoted saying this. He's partnering with groups, promoting chaos. And he's saying, don't get a permit. We're going to march regardless. And then he's going to the media and saying, we got to cancel a DNC. These counter-protesters are bad news.
What did you think? What was your answer to the New York Times headline this week? I guess it's the same story, Austin. Chicago would like everyone to stop talking about 1968 was the headline of one of the stories they had this week. We did have a convention in 1996, right? And that did not devolve into chaos. I wonder if this is a foregone conclusion that we're creating here by talking so much about 1968.
Well, 2012, I think we also had NATO or there
was
G7. Thank you. And it was totally fine.
Yeah.
But I do think people are rightfully worried, one, because you have public officials saying, go ahead, guys, like create chaos. I think that's yes. good. Two, you have this big campus movement that's creating conflict with police, and elements of that are being provocative. I also want to make sure that I'm not painting too broad of a brush, that not everybody who is for the Palestinian cause construed broadly is in favor of that kind of protest. Like, that's a very small number of students mm-hmm. even on a campus but they're very vocal and very visible. The comparisons are apt because of there's a time of popular student revolt against something the Democratic Party and the U.S. government is doing. And you didn't have that really in 2012. You didn't really have that in 1996. And you did have it in 68 with Vietnam, and you have it now with Palestine.
What is the message, Austin, that they are, and I know there's different campuses and different groups, but what do you think the message is? What do the protesters on these campuses across the country want?
Some variation, usually, and it's a broad swath of BDS, boycott, divest, sanction. But the issue I've always had with that, because I was on a college campus when there was a very large divest movement. And the idea is, hey, these universities have these really big endowments, and those endowments should not be holding stocks or at any kind of securities or assets or parts of companies that are somehow engaged in Israel or engaged in this conflict. And what I never understood about that was you have to sell the asset. And in order to sell the asset, someone else buys the asset. Like, this, it's not hurting the company. I don't understand how the divestiture of the endowment, even if every university were to do it, I don't know if it would affect the price, like, hardly at all. There's also some demands to cut off scholastic ties with universities that are in Israel. Yeah. It's a whole panoply of things. In comparison to actually protesting outside of, like, Chuck Schumer's house, that would seem to be a much greater delta in terms of we're pointing the spotlight on the right people, meaning the federal government, to take an action, versus like a university professor and board that, in the grand scheme of things, I feel like have a very small influence on the conflict. So their demands are entirely toward the universities, which I do think is odd.
Well, it's where they go to school. It's where they spend their time. It's where they live.
Beyond that, though, Austin, I don't understand the long-term goals of, say, disinvestment. Say we're able to cripple the Israeli economy, if that's the idea that you want to have here, or we're able to deprive them of intellectual resources. Is the goal of these protesters to get all the Jews to leave Palestine? Is it the goal of them to side with Hamas, who seems to be totally indifferent to Jewish life? Or is their goal a two-state solution? I don't know what their goal, what the long-term goal, the short-term goal of divestment, I don't even know what that's leading toward in terms of where these protesters are. I think there may be factions among them. But when you have the loudest and ugliest voices seeming to call for at least the eradication of Israel, if not the residents of Israel, you know, you leave me way behind with something like that.
The U.S. did halt bomb shipments today, though. I mean, you know, you wonder if maybe...
I think that hostilities need to cease over there. They need to start talking and stop killing each other. I would really like that to happen. I'm totally down with that. But I'm not down myself. I'm not down with getting rid of Israel. Israel's been there since 1948. You know, what happened to the Jews before that is horrific. And it just... You know, I mean, I know it's a very complicated story, very complicated region, a lot of conflicting claims, But I don't think that it's realistic or even decent to say we're going to get rid of the state of Israel and just give it back to the ancestors of the Palestinians who had to leave that land. That's not realistic. It's not going to happen. I'm not there.
Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson is in Springfield today. He is soliciting support for a new Bears stadium, new funding for the CTA, and as Austin Berg tweeted today, an extra billion to fund the $50 billion in contract demands from his largest campaign financier, the Chicago Teachers Union. Almost wish you hadn't put it that way, Austin, because they aren't asking for $50 billion for the CTU contract. That was a joke. That was a point that Stacey Davis Gates was making. I don't know if she's a jester, but she wasn't serious when she said that, and you paint that as though it was.
Yeah, and I would be very curious, if it's not $50 billion, what the estimate actually is that the CTU would say it costs.
So you're going to hold that over them until they give us a more serious answer.
That's the number that's been thrown out, and I don't care if it's in jest. If an honest broker looks at the 700-plus demands that they released, and by the way, they have still not released. The Illinois Policy Institute is the only entity that has released what the demands are. They have not, despite their calls for transparency. It would be, and I've showed this to people who are in Chicago public schools or who have worked in Chicago public schools administration, and they say, if these are serious, it could be more than $50 billion because they're unhinged. They're huge. So like for her to say this was a joke, which I did hear her say on Ben Jarofsky's show yesterday, and that's the first time I've heard her say that. She then follows it up with, well, next time I'm going to ask for $100 billion and 5 cents. Yeah, it might be a joke, but it also underscores two things. One, they won't say what the real number is because it is so absurd. And two, they don't want to recognize the reality that we live in a world with scarce resources that have to be distributed to different priorities. And the longer you can play in that world where all the money is available for you, and when someone asks you how you're going to pay for it, you get to say, that's actually not my job. It's the lawmaker's job to hike taxes to pay for it, aka I don't want to put my name on a tax hike because people will then not like me. I'm just going to live in a world where we can demand untold tens of billions of dollars and it will be fine. So that's why I bring up the $50 billion.
Well, her job is to advocate for her people, her side, her union members, right? It is the lawmaker's job to figure out who gets how much. That's a negotiation, right?
I don't know. If I was tasked with demanding money from taxpayers, I would probably come to the table with some ideas for how that money might be generated.
How did you get to 700 points? Well, how did you guys acquire that?
So we did this documentary on the CTU called Local One.
Yeah.
It was released last January.
Right.
And in the course of doing that film and in the months following that, we had many members of the CTU reach out to us and say, we don't like this. This does not reflect our beliefs. And people have to remember the current leadership structure of CTU, that's elected by members. And they were elected, this is Stacey Davis Gates, and since 2010, it's been this more radical caucus called CORE, the Caucus of Rank and File Educators. Those are people like Karen Lewis, Jesse Sharkey, Jackson Potter, Stacey Davis Gates, all come from CORE. CORE got like 56% of the vote, meaning there's 40%+ of CTU members who are not about all of this like extraordinarily extreme political spending and positioning. So those people, when they see stuff that's wrong, come to the Illinois Policy Institute, and that's how we got them.
They fed you that document that hasn't otherwise been released.
Correct.
Well, Brandon Johnson today, he said in his speech today in Springfield, he said that there's more than enough money to go around for everyone in Illinois, that we can all get what we need, which, again, it's like with Stacey Davis Gates. It seems really tone deaf to this, for the pension debt that we have in Illinois, and the budget problems they have in Illinois, that there are priorities, and that the way of putting it, I think it's very important when you're trying to win the hearts and minds of downstate legislators and voters too, to point out that these are urgent matters, and that this is something that we're going to have to require balancing our priorities, and here is the argument why we think our priority is more important than other priorities, because things do have to give. There's not enough for everybody to get everything they want. And that was kind of the implication of what he said. I feel like that the approach that the CTU takes in its public statements seems extremely dismissive of any concerns that taxpayers have or anybody has about what it's going to cost to do all the things that they want. And I think a lot of things they want are, you know, on the surface or without thinking about how much they cost are reasonable. I mean, you want a librarian at every school. Yeah, that's reasonable. Some of these things, you want teachers to make enough to, so they can live decent lives. That's reasonable too. But just the attitude that they take, I mean, I know they're advocates. I know they're taking a side, but they want this to be a public negotiation. They want to have these union talks done in public. And the public, I think, as a member of the public, I want to see both sides struggle with this. I want to see them say, look, we realize there are other priorities. We realize that the CTA is in a lot of trouble. We realize that we have real housing problems in the city. We have policing issues. We have all kinds of issues that we need to deal with. And this is one of the priorities, but this is why we feel like these particular elements of the education funding requests are the most reasonable. That's kind of what I want to hear from them, but every time I hear Stacey Davis Gates talk, I think like, screw you, come on, you know, like, what are you talking about?
I know.
I'm someone who tends to be very sympathetic to much more so than Austin, you know, in terms of the teachers union and so on. But
everybody's
but
more
man.
Sympathetic than Austin to the teachers.
Well, that's true. Austin does define.
But you haven't been having to toil in the trenches of watching every YouTube speech of these and every financial report that comes out. I was not born as like the nemesis of the Chicago Teachers Union. There's many people.
No, you come by it honestly. I will give you that.
There were members of these unions, and I don't relish in the fact that I dislike them, but they've gotten by so long with their name, which is Chicago Teachers Union, which is like rainbows, puppies, chocolate in Chicago. Everybody loves Chicago. Everybody loves teachers. Everybody loves unions. And they've gotten away with so much ridiculous and harmful rhetoric and action over the last 10 years because of that name. And that's why I get passionate about it.
Austin, you
it
mentioned
perception of teachers. That's the last point. Sorry.
You mentioned the relatively small percentage that Stacey Davis Gates and her running mates had won by, 56% to 40%. But I'm wondering, do we know how many Chicago teachers are disenchanted enough with that leadership that they've stepped away from the union? Because I have a friend who's a longtime Chicago teacher who is in a position that has her visit lots of different Southside schools. So she absolutely does not think they are funded well enough. There are schools that she has to bring her own toilet paper for. And I'm just wondering, since she mentioned that some teachers are just kind of dropping out, is there any way to know what kind of number of people might actually take that step?
We know from people who we've helped opt out of the union that there are hundreds of CPS teachers that have taken that step. And that's due to a 2016 Supreme Court case where an Illinois worker named Mark Janus went to the Supreme Court and he said, you shouldn't be forced to pay a union just to keep your public sector job. So every public sector worker, teachers, road, whatever it is, you're allowed to opt out and stop paying the union. And many of them do, partially because the CTU only spends 17 cents of every dollar it raises on teacher representation, which is another part. Like, we say Chicago Teachers Union, you'd think a union, all they're doing is just representing teachers. Only 17% of the money goes to actual teacher representation. The rest goes to all sorts of other stuff.
Like what? Give me an example.
People politics, they can fund it into politics. They can fund it into administrative salaries, things like that.
Okay, keep going.
Not defending teachers in administrative disputes with the school, which ostensibly is the purpose.
So is there a way to find out how many teachers have opted out?
They report their top line numbers of members every year, but they don't have to go in and report to the federal government. This many people opted out of the union this year. Okay. And the reality is, and I know now of two very clear cases where this has happened, where a person decides to take that right, and they're saying, I don't want to pay $1,500 a year to this group because I don't like what they're doing.
Yeah.
And they will face interpersonal and professional backlash for that decision. And when that happens to you, there are ways you can get other legal representation for cheaper than the CTU, but that's a scary place to be. That's you, you are, you know, kind of sticking your neck out.
That becomes known when you opt out? That becomes known?
It should be private, but the union knows who opts out because you have to tell them you're opting out.
You're not sending in your dues anymore. The only people who need to worry about what Kristi Noem says are the people in her home state of South Dakota, and maybe dog owners and goat lovers or goats. But the story about the best-selling author and would-be running mate to Donald Trump did get more serious or interesting this week when CBS's Margaret Brennan called her out for the lie her book was going to peddle, that she had met with Kim Jong-un. She's still peddling the protect my family thing. She did not meet with Kim Jong-un. I've been wondering, why is it so hard for her to just say, look, I had a ghostwriter. They wrote the book. This happens. The problem with her saying, and I didn't catch it, is the problem with that is that she narrates the book. so she read that word into the recording. So unless it was AI generated, they sampled her voice and then had a computer read it. I don't know how she can explain this away, but she sure is trying. How seriously should we take this story? It's amazing to me, no pun intended now, the legs this thing has, because you'd think it's a goofball politician from South Dakota nobody cares about, and she shot her dog. Next. I mean, why is this thing still lingering?
Because in all politics, especially presidential politics, there's an oppo file on everyone, and someone's known this about her for a long time and has waited for an opportune time to drop it. And they're seeing the fact that, oh, Trump's, you know, picking his next VP. And that very much could be friendly fire from within Republican ranks, right? It could be other people who want to be vice president, and they're leaking a story about all this dirt that they have on Kristi Noem so that she has less odds of being vice president, chosen to be vice president.
I wondered last week if this wasn't going to help her, but it seems like Republicans like dogs too, so this isn't. Eric, do you think she's seriously off the list now? She's disqualified herself?
I think so. The whole Kim Jong-un story is very odd because, as you point out, she did say those words when she read the audiobook. And it's sort of the Charles Barkley defense. If you remember Charles Barkley, when someone asked him about something weird that he said in his own autobiography, he just blamed his ghostwriter. He said he didn't even read it. It just seems beyond my comprehension that someone, especially someone that as prominent as Kristi Noem, would have had a book and not with her name on it and not read it for errors, and then read the offending passage into the audiobook. Her lies about it are just awful. And what she says is, I'm not going to talk about, she's not going to deny that she didn't meet. She's not going to say, I didn't meet with Kim Jong-un. She says, I'm not going to talk about my conversations with world leaders.
Yeah.
As though she would, as the governor of South stinking Dakota, is going to have a confidential conversation with any world leader. It's amazing to me that a world leader would want to meet with someone who is so fundamentally insignificant as the governor of South Dakota. I mean, and no disrespect to South Dakota. Well, a little disrespect
some
to South
taken.
Dakota. But if she's going to meet with Macron, who she said she was going to meet with and was not scheduled to, or these people are not going to go, well, I must rethink my position because the governor of South Dakota. That's such a lie. And the idea that she can't talk about, you could say, you come out of a meeting with Kim Jong-un and say, we had a frank exchange of ideas, whatever she can talk about. It's just so transparent. On the other hand, being a transparent liar has not proven to be that much of an impediment in the Republican Party these days. So she could still be on the list, but I doubt it. I think that she just would draw too much heat, be too much of a distraction. He's probably going to pick someone like Elise Stefanik. It'd be my guess right now.
Nikki Haley, maybe? No?
Yeah, I know. Nikki Haley has really ripped him up and down even this year, and I don't see him picking Nikki Haley.
Ron DeSantis is endorsing him now. I mean, it's funny how that they have an off switch. All of that goes away.
Well, Lindsey Graham is off on. Yeah, J.D. Vance would be a strong candidate. Although I do think that I think he likes having people near him who used to despise him and now have come around. I don't think Nikki Haley can be that person because she despised him and then she was with him and then she despised him again. I just think she would be too much of a distraction. I think it's going to be someone like Stefanik, not Marjorie Taylor Greene, not anyone who's extremely polarizing.
You know,
I don't know.
Kate, maybe I shouldn't plumb the book for logic or her statements, but it seemed to me like I'm not going to talk about my conversations with world leaders should be the very things you should be talking about. I mean, that sounds substantive. So what did you say? What did they say? What have we learned? What have you learned? That's the one thing you should be talking about.
It does kind of contribute to my current theory that almost everything can be related to a Seinfeld episode. I'm sure we all recall that Elaine had to write Mr. Peterman's autobiography, and he was so boring that they had to buy Kramer's life anecdotes.
Kramer, my friend, that is one ripping good yarn.
If you like that one, I got more. And what are you looking for? Romance? Comedy? Adventure? Erotica?
No, Kramer, I don't think...
How much would you take for the whole lot?
My whole life.
Name your price, man.
$1,500.
I'll give you half that.
Done.
I'm thinking that's what she did.
Yeah. Did she not think this was going to get figured out? That somebody would go, no, you didn't. And by the way, Austin, about the leak, quote unquote, if it had not been brought to our attention of late, it's her book. She was going to out herself for having met with Kim Jong-un or not and having shot the dog and the goat. You know, she was going to tell those stories. The only leak is that we found them in advance, and maybe it scuttled her vice presidential hopes. Yeah, I guess it worked that way. Okay, Austin, you got to go, right? Peace out, man. Thanks for sitting in with us today.
Talk to you soon.
Austin Berg, who's evidently got more important things to do than this. Hard to imagine.
I can't imagine his priorities are just out of whack.
Maybe we should pay him to be on the podcast. I don't know. Let's just talk about this Chicago story, guys, and that is that both our newspapers have editorialized about something that we have been talking about on WGN Radio, too, and that is, should the speed limit in Chicago be lowered from 30 miles an hour to 25 miles an hour on our city streets? The survivability of a pedestrian accident with a car goes much, much higher, maybe not surprisingly, but the statistic is pretty amazing if you're driving at 23 miles an hour versus 30 miles an hour, that it goes from something like 75% mortality to under 25% mortality, that if we would just lower it by those 5 miles an hour, that so many more people would survive being hit by a car. I understand that. But then let's go 2 miles an hour. Nobody would ever get injured or hurt. There has to be a line. It's kind of weighing the individual's good versus the common good. And a reasonable common good is getting somewhere and also not being constantly fined because you've inched over the speed limit.
Well, first of all, I have a couple of thoughts. One is that I just read, I think it was last week, that there is a new mandate on cars, which is that they have to have automatic braking systems in them. That is going to lower pedestrian deaths significantly. I take your point exactly about, 30 miles an hour, you have X number of fatalities, you'd lower it to 25. Well, what if you lowered it to 20? What if you lowered it to 15? There was something in Brandon Johnson's transition proposal that talked about like a 10 mile an hour speed limit on side streets, which, I mean, at some point, yeah, you could lower the speed limit on interstates to 40, but there is a cost. There's a social cost to people being stuck in traffic longer. There's an environmental cost to cars being out on the road longer. And I think striking the balance is an important thing. And I'd like to see a lot more in the way of studies about this, about where they've done it, and what the long tail effects of something like that are. It does seem to me that the problem is not 30 miles an hour, but the problem is people who see the 30 mile an hour speed limit and take it to mean 40 and go too fast and go much faster than they should. And if they better enforce the 30 mile an hour speed limit, they could probably achieve the same sort of life savings that they're going to positing here. And of course, the other thing is the enforcement aspect. Is this just a cash grab? Are they going to set up speed cameras all over the place and catch people going at a fairly pokey 25 miles an hour? I was thinking about this the other day. I was driving on Irving Park Road and going 30 miles an hour. It just didn't feel all that fast. Irving Park Road's four lane road, and I was thinking, man, 25 would feel really slow on this road, and that didn't seem right to me.
Consideration is not just did it feel slow, but did it feel unsafe? Mm-hmm. Do you feel that at 30 miles an hour, you are in control of your car, that you can manage the situation?
I guess I didn't think about it in those terms, but I do feel like I can stop for any pedestrian who is crossing at a crosswalk or.
Well, that's what I'm asking.
I feel like that's a safe speed on those major arterial roads. If you're going 30, a little bit over 30, there are stretches of Pulaski that go by a bunch of cemeteries, and it feels really slow to go 30. And I always do because I don't want to get any more of these little ticky tack 5 miles an hour over the speed limit tickets.
Yeah.
But six. Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like that there is this balance to be struck, and it seems like the balance we have is pretty good right now. That's why I would want to be convinced more by more statistics or something before.
This is the kind of question Kate would ask too, which is, I wonder if there's any way to know what percentage of the people who are hit by cars are hit because it's the pedestrian who's looking at their phone or blindly walking out from behind a truck that's parked by the stop sign and they did not exercise caution themselves. That sounds terribly harsh when we're considering what happens to those people. But I wonder to what degree it's not 5 miles an hour. It's pedestrians who just aren't paying attention.
Are you attributing this argument to Kate? Is that what I heard you do?
That's what it sounded like.
I almost started to do my Kate.
You know, what I'm thinking is, though, that there's no point in lowering it to 25 unless you're going to seriously ramp up enforcement. Otherwise, it means nothing. So if you're going to seriously ramp up enforcement, then what you're talking about is hitting lots and lots more people with those tickets, which, as we've already noted, starting with Lori Lightfoot, are now for just going 6 miles an hour over the limit, which is just crazy in and of itself. And you're also, so you're going to have lots more of these red light tickets, and you're going to have a lot more, I assume, police pulling people over. And aren't both things that especially Mayor Johnson's administration would look at as not being good for equity, because these things,
true.
I would agree. I would completely agree that these things really hit hard, so much harder against people who don't have a lot of money to pay these tickets. 6 miles an hour over the speed limit is nothing. But if they want to do anything with this, that's what they're going to have to do. So it doesn't make any sense to me.
Have you asked your listeners about this, Sean? Has this been a daily click poll?
Yeah, or? It was one of our news clicks. And I'm looking at producer Pete, and I don't remember how that shook out. I think people were on my side on this one, weirdly. And that is, I'm not in favor of 25. I think 30 is onerous enough. I think 30 is difficult enough. I think 30 is safe enough. I think that the issue is screens in cars and screens on people's phones when they're walking through crosswalks. There's a whole lot of other things competing for our attention. Maybe none of that matters to the advocates of this. That is, they don't care if it's meteors falling from the sky. The point is, the death toll was 1,200 people last year, I think was the number, killed in traffic accidents in Illinois, which sounds like a really big number to me.
How many of those are on city streets, though? And I mean, I'm guessing most of those were on rural highways or interstates, not city streets. And how many of them were from people who were just going a little bit over the speed limit, and how many were people were drag racing and so on? I mean, I think these are really urgent questions.
Yeah,
I know those things went way up during COVID, right? People really started driving like maniacs, but that's kind of the point. That's where the real issue is, I think. Although God knows they have not given us the research to tell us one way or another, which is what they really should do before they come out with these kind of pronouncements.
Yeah.
But it seems like the problem is not people who are going 30 miles an hour, but people who are going 40 and 50
and
on regular streets. And they're there, and I see them.
It was 60-40. 60% of the listeners agreed with me we should leave it at 30, 60%.
Yeah, I think that's probably that's a fair representation of what I would guess is public opinion. One last thing is that if we really wanted to reduce pedestrian deaths, we would ban these large SUVs. That's, I think, where a lot of this problem is coming from, is that cars are a lot heavier than they used to be. And that if you were to, and your sight line is higher, so you don't maybe see people who are down low, but we would never do that. We would never think, okay, well, in the city, you can't drive this kind of car. You can't drive something large like that. Like I say, I think it's really important to look at all the pedestrian deaths and look at what the factors were in them. And if the factor in them was someone was going 35 miles an hour and the driver was at fault, then you can put that on the lower the speed limit side of the ledger. If it's somebody jumping out between a car or somebody who is disobeying traffic signals and trying to run across the street or whatever, and someone hits them going 25 or 30 miles an hour at the speed limit, then that's not a chit in favor of the ordinance. So,
what was your reaction to the abortion clinic noise ordinance that has been introduced into the city council?
I'm all in favor of protest. I am opposed to harassment, and I said that earlier in this podcast about the students that these protesters are free to wave their signs and chant and so on, but hassling people, putting loudspeakers up, making it so they can't conduct business in the clinic because they're being bombarded by noise, that to me obviously crosses the line. And there are safe zones around hospitals, like quiet zones, and there should be quiet zones around these clinics as well. I think it can be fairly content neutral. I don't want to have anybody protesting any cause, no matter what I think about that cause, that's going to make people's day-to-day lives difficult or very, very stressful because they've got noise going all the time.
It is a medical procedure. You don't like it, but it's a medical procedure. So
I'm pro-choice, but I'm saying it doesn't matter to me the content of their speech. What matters to me is the harassment that goes on. I would not support someone standing outside your apartment in Chicago, John, with a bullhorn saying, you know, lower the speed limit, John Williams is wrong. I mean, that would be insane. That would be awful. That's harassment. That's not protest. If they want to walk back and forth in front of your house with a sandwich board saying John Williams is wrong about the speed limit, then okay. But they can't make it hard for you to sleep or watch TV or go about your life. That's sort of how I look at those things. And so I'm all in favor of this ordinance.
Seems like they should be able to make it fairly content neutral in that it seems like any clinic that performs medical procedures should be eligible to get this coverage if they want it. And then those who need it will apply for it and get it.
Do they have a way then of measuring the volume? Is that what?
I think so. I don't know how those hospital ordinances work, but I mean, there are certainly... There's equipment that measures decibels, and there may be a decibel threshold that they have, or maybe an informal one. But yeah, I'm sure there is.
So Steve Albini, the noted Chicago engineer, producer, frontman on the indie music scene, has passed away, 61 years old, of a heart attack. And that's not a name that was on my radar, but my producer Pete sure noticed it. I know Austin knew the music that this guy produced and performed. Kate, you did too, right?
Yeah. Completely coincidentally went to college with Steve Albini, and I really have not seen him since college. But as anybody who knows of him will not be surprised, he's the kind of college person who, like, you keep track of and you remember him very, very well. He had a punk band back then called Big Black, which he then got back together a little later. It's been together for decades, I think, altogether. And just to give you an idea, their first album, I believe it was their first album, was called More Songs About, and then a word that begins with F, which I am sure we cannot say on this show. And that was like Steve Albini. He was definitely always looking for a way to get a rise out of people, that's for sure. But he was also a very sweet guy. He liked to just sit around and play board games, as I recall. He wasn't like out partying necessarily all night in college. What I really remember most about him was not like I had lots and lots of parties, but me and my roommates did have one particular party that I remember. He was arguing at like 4 o'clock in the morning and they would not leave, him and another person who, not a close friend, but one of my college people, Dennis O'Hare, who is an actor who you may have seen in some movies, like he's got a great part in Michael Clayton, especially, I remember. And he was a classical music enthusiast. And these two would not stop arguing about what music was. And Dennis O'Hare was arguing, like, you know, music must be this, this, and this. And Steve Albini was like, no, if I hit this wall and I want that to be music, that's music. to sew him. But he was very, very well known in alternative music circles and produced albums for some of the biggest people, like Nirvana.
Yeah, Nirvana, In Utero.
Yeah.
Died of a heart attack at an appallingly young age, from my point of view.
You know, the story you just told reminds me a little bit about the John Mulaney Netflix stream last night. So he's doing a series of consecutive live streams, and then you can watch them afterwards. Griffin and I watched, I think it was the third episode last night live, and had watched the first one as well. And one of the bits they did, and it's really uneven, I think. I think Mulaney's great, and there's moments where you go, oh, that's the John Mulaney I love, but he's trying to do like this live talk show. He has a couple of featured guests, and then they go to packaged bits, and they do interviews. One of the bits they did was where they interviewed a bunch of aging punk band names, and they were all in the same room together, and they were talking about what music is and isn't, and how the fans would spit on them, and just the behavior and the whole scene. And it was it was kind of interesting, you know, and kind of funny. It was kind of a good idea, I think, but none of it really came together for me. I'm not exactly sure what Mulaney's trying to do here. Maybe just, you know, hey, it's a gig and it's different. I like thinking out of the box. It almost feels, though, like a live audition for a late night talk show. Like, what if Mulaney had a show? This is what it would look like.
I thought that's what it was supposed to be, actually, and I completely forgot he was starting that. Is that on Netflix?
Yeah.
Or
9 o'clock?
It is?
Yeah, watch it live. Okay. Or watch it afterwards. But it did remind me, too, of when Conan first started, or when any of the guys, you know, after Johnny Carson left, and then there was a big reshuffling of the deck, Jay Leno and all of those, and David Letterman, and everybody was trying to figure out who was going to be where and who was going to be next. And when some of them came on right away, Jimmy Fallon and Conan O'Brien, I thought, oh, this is weak. These guys are not good. It's very uneven. They're just finding their way. And that's what it felt like to me with John Mulaney.
Well, those two did grow into their jobs.
Absolutely.
Sure,
absolutely.
And maybe he's going to also.
And Mulaney's got chops. He's the greatest. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, I love him.
And a lot of sympathy for him out there, too. So I hope it's whatever he wants to do, I wish him well.
Well, I'm going to take a look at it, though, even though you're telling me it's not good.
The worst were Pat Sajak. He had a brief run. Well, Chevy Chase, I think, had a brief run. Arsenio had a legitimate run, but that came and went. But you remember when
what
all
about
these...
the Larry Sanders show? It's so funny because we're rewatching it right now, and we just saw the episode with Pat Sajak.
Really?
Everyone was laughing and going, can you believe he had a talk show?
Yep, that's
and
true.
I didn't remember that either.
It was horrible. It made you appreciate the people who do those things well, because it looks pretty easy. You know, Jimmy Kimmel's up there. He says what he says, and then funny people come on, and everybody laughs, and it works. And they banter with the band, and the banter just it's not happening.
Could it be done on purpose, though? It seems like the sort of thing he would do, purposely bad banter, maybe.
I don't think
That's an ironic thing?
Nah, no, you be
okay,
the judge.
We'll see.
Speaking of things that are harder to do, I have done some guest hosting on some radio shows, and it really ups my appreciation for the job you do, John, because it's not easy, I found, to run a radio show, keep it interesting, keep the conversation going. So it's like maybe it looks easy, but and that's your job. Your job is to make it sound easy, like I'm just John, I'm just here in the studio. But these things take more skill than it looks like.
Well, I got my 10,000 hours in or reps, and it's I think the same way people who talk for a living or maybe are on TV, not that I ever was, feel about writers. You go, I can write a column. I can do that. I mean, everybody's on Facebook. I could do that. And then you say, okay, write a good one that's well-researched, interesting, and relevant, and then do it 3 days a week or 5 days a week or 1 day a week, and then get back to me and see how easy that is. I don't know how good all of this was, but we're out of time. Eric, Kate, Austin clicked out a little bit ago. Good to see you guys. We'll be seeing you on stage in June.
One thing, Kate, you sound really good. Do you have a microphone now?
Yeah, I noticed that your audio is better.
No, I guess I was just wondering if I would not sound good. I'm stuck in my older daughter's bedroom. She doesn't really live here anymore, but it's still her room because I am affected by the varnish on our new windows. This room did not get a new window, so I'm like living in this room for a couple of weeks.
Wow.
And I had to close the back window because people are in the backyard. and I've got the fan going over me. So I was just sitting here thinking, is that fan really loud? Do I sound awful because of that fan?
Maybe we should get the Yeti company or whatever to sponsor us for a couple episodes and give us some microphones, because these are good, I think.
That's Eric Zorn, Kate Plies, Austin Had to Pop Out. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another pod on you next week. All righty, groovy kids. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
See you guys.
All right. Thanks, Kate. Good All stuff. Right. See you guys
See you
around.
Later.
You bet.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.